So the ones that came to the road,
you are?
Yeah. And they call us.
Interrupting.
Yeah.
That's what your capital's for.
Sorry, guys, here.
Fourth table.
Get a quarter mile, do a talk.
All right, I will call this Monday, April 9th, 2012, planning commission meeting to order. Kim, if you would take the roll call, please.
Chairman Luke.
I'm here.
Commissioner Demarest.
Here.
Commissioner Christensen.
Here.
Commissioner Rodland.
Here.
Commissioner Sherwood.
Here.
Commissioner Tell.
Here.
Thank you. This is the time in our meeting where we take comments from citizens on anything that is not currently on the agenda. We will be addressing those later in the meeting. Is there anyone here that wants to address the planning commission on anything that is not on the agenda tonight? All right, thank you. We have no meetings this evening, so we will jump right into our workshops. Our first workshop of the evening is CPA 2011-01, East Monroe Comprehensive Plan Amendment and Rezone. And Planning Manager Pogalka, I believe you were heading that up.
Yes.
Thank you. Over to you then, thank you.
Okay. We've had several workshops on this, and I had intended to have before you tonight, before we met tonight, a pretty complete staff analysis of the findings and conclusions and so forth. And that is not complete. I did not get that done. But I do have some information about the direction we're headed on this project with our analysis, and we can go through that. But I have just a few slides for the benefit of the audience. I think we're all pretty familiar with this. North side of Highway 2, just east of town, with the Snoqualmie River just to the south. It's about 68 acres, but 18 of that acres, of those acres have been removed that are in the shoreline area. Kim, you don't have the laser view. Which is along the northwesterly part of the property. And just to back up, and this This application, now down to about 50 acres, has about 25 acres of buildable area. That's after you subtract all of the critical areas and the buffers to those areas. And the environmental impact statement dealt with those buildable areas. In other words, not allowing any sort of development in those critical areas. But moving along, we talked about this before. There's some, you know, potentially positive aspects to this project. It's a great place for commercial in terms of its visibility. No doubt, I think anyone in real estate would agree that it's an enviable place in terms of its basic location from a point of visibility and traffic. And there are some other direct and perhaps indirect benefits to the city. On the other hand, this project also has a lot of issues, a lot of potential impacts, whether they be direct impacts or indirect impacts. Really, this has been at least preliminarily addressed in the environmental impact statement, but there are issues that will need to be addressed. If this is approved, issues that will need to be addressed in much more detail as this goes along. Things like the critical areas, the wetlands, the buffer zones, some serious problems with flooding. This property has had intermittent flooding the last number of years, and there's a question of where is the flood storage going to happen if this is developed. FEMA is categorizing this as being in the 100-year floodplain, although now it is not in that floodplain, but they are revising their mapping to put this entire piece in the 100-year flood. Certainly issues with traffic, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we move along, based on a meeting I had in the last week or 10 days with DOT. Some visual impacts. This item about commercial growth, the question becomes, can and should Monroe support commercial development on this parcel based on the existing inventory of commercial ground in the city and the combined with the empty office or professional office and retail space we have, and then the matter of economic feasibility. So here's the direction we're headed with our analysis. There's a number of criteria that we have to address, that we address when we analyze any comp plan amendment. It addresses things like public health, safety and welfare. Are there any potential adverse impacts to public health and safety? And my attitude is yes, there are some potential impacts, particularly in terms of traffic, Highway 2, and in terms of potential flooding. It, in staff's judgment, is not consistent with the comprehensive plan. In review of goals and policies, and in review of the Growth Management Act, we have a difficult time finding consistent, supportive goals and policies that would support rezoning this to general commercial. We also have to consider things, the cumulative effects of this. This comp plan alone has some impacts, positive, negatives. We also have to consider it in the context of other plan amendments and the rest of the community. And in our opinion, it does not readily meet some additional things, like environmental impacts, like the growth projections that we have for the community. Do we need more commercial ground? Is it compatible with neighboring areas? Is it compatible or consistent with the not just the words, goals and policies of the comp plan, but the intent of it? Now, there's some gray area there. What is the real intent here? And it's not supported by that. And it does comply. We're going through the CEPA process. We've done an environmental impact statement. The final EIS, based on the comments that have been received, should be coming out this week. But I'm going to have a lot more detail, written detail, which I hope to get out in the next couple of days even, well before our next meeting, that will explain these conclusions and specifically how it does or does not meet these criteria. But right now, the direction we're headed is that is recommending denial rather than approval of this comp plan amendment. This map shows that the letters A, B, C, etc. are the individual parcels that all together total about 50 acres. You can see the red line. The red areas are fairly high class wetlands. The brighter green are wetlands, and then buffers around each of those reaches. What it leaves is a buildable area in A, B, and C of about 18 acres. And in F, below the farmstead, the old farm setting, of about 7 acres to the east. Okay, DOT. If you look at this slide, that ABC property now is entitled for one church and 4 single-family residences. DOT will grant a temporary access to that property, say below the letter C. I don't know if you can see, but there's a farm field entrance. But they would grant a temporary access, meaning that when the bypass is built, and who knows when that's going to be, but when the bypass is built, that access will go away, and DOT will build an access road from just to the east of E. Well, you see the drive that goes to the farm, just to the west of that. DOT will build a frontage road from Highway 2 to the to that parcel E. They call it SR 14, I think, something like that. Frontage Road 14. They will build from Highway 2 a frontage road to serve that church and those four residences. Now, if this property is rezoned and wants to be developed as something other than a church and four residences, when that bypass is built, DOT plans a roundabout where you see that circle where it comes down from the northwest, intersects with Highway 2. The applicant would have to build a roundabout at that point where I was just talking about the frontage road. Where the green wetland comes down along the letter E. Oh, goodness, for a laser pointer.
I gave you
see
one,
where?
I gave you one right there.
There's one right there.
Right.
Oh, it is.
But don't aim it at me.
I'm sorry. Sorry. Yourself.
I'm not paying attention. Here we go. Frontage road we built right here to serve access to this property. That temporary access for a church and four homes could be built right here. DOT will allow that as a temporary until such time as the bypass is built with a roundabout here. Now, if the owner of this property decides, or this property decides, but particularly this one, decides to build something other than what is entitled, say a commercial center, before DOT does their improvements, before the bypass is finished and they improve this area, the owner will have to build a roundabout here, two-lane roundabout, similar in some ways to what we have on the end of West Main, and build a frontage road to serve access into this parcel, which would be across the wetlands here. DOT will approve or is not opposed to construction of a roundabout at this point. However, this temporary access, as I said, is good only for a church and four homes. Anything else and all bets are off, and we're immediately into a roundabout at this point. So access is possible. It may not be easy or it may not be very inexpensive to build, but it's possible to gain access to this property. So in the long run, and just to clarify, if the Highway 2 bypass is built and DOT does these improvements, and they will build a frontage road to this point right here, so that this property will continue to have access after the temporary is removed.
Thank you. Commissioners, any questions on this matter?
Yes. You said that they would put a two-lane roundabout.
The applicant would be required to build a two-lane.
That's for a four-lane road
roundabout.
A two-lane, would that be for a four-lane?
That's for a two-lane Highway 2.
Highway 2. And the gentleman was here at one of the meetings, said that the state might have put a four-lane from here to Sultan. That's the case of a two-lane roundabout wouldn't work.
I believe that one letter we saw from DOT called for two lanes each direction in the roundabout design, anticipating that potential four-lane
and
ultimately.
Okay.
But I would have to look back
and
let it. It's just my recollection.
Yeah, got to clarify that.
Question? Yeah, Dave?
Paul, you talk about how the property can currently develop with a access at that one, the northern side of that dam, I guess, outside the curve of the dam there. And that if the roundabout gets built, DOT would move that frontage road down to that southeast corner of E?
They would abandon, close this access and build a frontage road from their right-of-way to this corner so that they are providing access to this parcel.
And they're not saying that as a part of that improvement they would do a traffic circle. They would just literally move the frontage or the access point from where it's going to be temporarily jammed to that more easterly position.
Correct.
Okay.
It's strictly an access point, and it does not involve a roundabout. And that is, like I said, on the basis of up to a church and four homes.
All right. Thank you. Commissioners, any other questions so far? Staff?
And actually, I think this is the last slide in this group. Now, DOT is of the opinion that this is not going to happen for quite a few years still. So this temporary access could actually function for quite some time up to that certain level of development. Any commercial development would trigger access from here to come across to serve that property. No roundabout until this happens. Roundabout and frontage road for that commercial activity.
So if I may, I guess paraphrase what you said, so I make sure I understand that the temporary access is allowed as long as it's the church and four homes.
Right.
Once the bypass is built, or if we were to go to commercial, the applicant will be required to build a roundabout further east.
If it goes,
and then the state would build a small frontage road.
If it goes commercial, yes, it's all up to the applicant. If the state finishes that bypass before the applicant would build anything here, the state would build them this access road.
But including the roundabout?
The roundabout.
Okay, so.
The roundabout's not required for church and four homes.
Gotcha. Right. Thank you.
So that probably that'll help straighten out the, just exactly where DOT is at.
Bill?
I'm still confused. If there is commercial going in there, say, down the road somewhere, mm-hmm. that access road that the state would put in, is that the only access then for that commercial property?
That's right. The state would allow it. They would not build it. But they would allow an access here from a roundabout with commercial development. That makes sense.
Well, when would that road be put in then? Would the road be put in before it would be commercial, that access road? You said the state would put that in for a church and four.
Right. They'll allow access, where is it, here, for
temporary,
a church,
yeah.
Four homes.
Okay.
A driveway, basically.
Okay, all right. So when would that other road be put in? If it went, that's the only time you put in it, there was commercial?
If it went commercial, no matter when that was, that would trigger the roundabout and the frontage road access. That would close that temporary.
All right.
Depending on who pays for the frontage road is who gets there first.
Who gets there first.
All right. 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 Okay. Any development other than, a church and five houses would trigger a roundabout,
okay.
Literally.
Right. Dave?
Well, as I understand the issue of concurrency, and I think this is what I've seen in the past, if there's impacts identified from the development and there's a plan put in place for funding improvements to mitigate those impacts, those improvements have to be done within 6 years of the impact's start.
Yes, that's correct.
Would that
for
same
concurrency.
For concurrency, would that same rule of law come into play here? Or would this be something where the state could actually say, no, you cannot occupy that property until you've made the improvement?
Oh, I see. No, I believe that as a condition of access to that, they would have to build a roundabout for any higher level of development.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Now, there would be no period of waiting period for that concurrency. And I'm not sure that this could be effectively built without, I don't think it could be built without sewer and water extended from Lewis, from this area, Lewis and Main Street and Highway 2. It may take something like a lift station and a force main, but sewer and water are about a mile away at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wayne?
The state is going to pay for the roundabout now if it goes through commercial, say?
No.
No. Okay. The people are going to develop that.
Right.
Ooh.
Right. The state, the most that the state would do is build this frontage road access if they make these improvements with the bypass. Well, that's
prior to
10 to 20 years away.
The city wouldn't have to be involved in any of the building of that roundabout then?
No.
Because it gets
pretty expensive. Not financially. No. In fact, it would be a state approved project. Okay. If it's all entirely within DOT right of way.
Paul, I got a question. Not on the map, but on this DAF analysis and an amendment. You kind of tipped your hand, obviously, to where you were leaning. And I was just curious, does the applicant know that where that kind of these issues? And
no, I just put this together this afternoon.
Okay.
I've been working on the written report, which gets fairly complicated since there's so many pieces to this.
Sure.
But when I realized that it would not be complete, I just did the basic summary. And I'm not really prepared to talk about the real specifics and the details of, you know, these specific goals or these specific requirements, but that will come out as this written summary comes together.
Great. And that'll just be in 2 weeks when we have the public hearing?
Well, you'll have it this week, but well ahead of that April 23rd date. But for the benefit of the audience, there is a public hearing scheduled on this project and the First Air Comp Plan Amendment and the North Kelsey Comp Plan Amendment on the 23rd of April. It'll be a public hearing and scheduled for a commission to make a recommendation to council that night.
So buy some coffee on the way in. Thank you. Commissioners, any Dave?
Paul, you're saying here that the application to date, or at least the environmental review that's been done, complies with the CEPA process, and I take it satisfies apparently the CEPA process. And I know that the phase EIS talks a lot about how this application itself will have no environmental impacts, and that it's only a planned action, I think is what it calls it. It's not a project review or project analysis. How down the road, if in fact this were to be approved and it got redesignated and rezoned, how do cumulative effects of the entire rezone come into to be evaluated or analyzed if we are at that point looking at individual projects rather than the whole project area, potential project area? How do the cumulative effects get analyzed?
Well, if it is approved for a land use change and a zoning change, which is a change in the color of the map, non-project action, that's the point where cumulative effects should be considered, whether in favor or not in favor. But I'm thinking that if it is rezoned, then that property is entitled. And the owner is entitled to build whatever is permitted for that property. We've been through that long list of potential uses. But the only issue in terms of cumulative effects would be things like say, a drainage or flooding, and what impact that property has on the hydrology of that area that's caused directly by that project. We're talking about stormwater control, you know, flooding control, that sort of thing. But it's specific to that property in the immediate area. It's not community-wide cumulative.
But so if it gets redesignated and rezoned, they do a short plat out there or boundary line adjustment, some comes in for an application on 5 acres, and somehow they've addressed the issues of access and they've got their necessary utilities out there, and they want to fill this 5 acres to make sure that it's above any floodplain concerns. that's only a small part of this project area. And in and of itself, it has very little impact on the environment. But if you do that 5-acre development, the second, the third, and fourth, and then the fifth time, all of a sudden the cumulative effect is significant, perhaps. And yet, are you saying, or are we saying that that potential cumulative effect would only be evaluated on the third or the fourth or the fifth application, not on the first or the second? And that, it goes back to my concerns that I expressed 2 weeks ago with regard to there really isn't any evaluation of those impacts that's been done in the FEES EIS to date. And I guess I'm just wondering in the process where that would happen, how that would happen.
Well, all I can say is that at least in the theoretically, in terms of process, each step would have to address any potential impacts from the beginning baseline, whether it be flooding, stormwater, critical areas, whatever it might be, would have to thoroughly mitigate the effect it would have. Now, the magic is in determining what is that immediate effect, so that there is no incremental increase in impact until there is a significant impact. So in terms of flooding, for example, if you develop this piecemeal a few acres at a time, and each one reduces the flood storage capacity of that property or creates problems downstream, or upstream, I should say, for flooding, that should be addressed at each step to avoid that, what could become a cumulative impact.
We certainly didn't take that sort of approach with the traffic analysis for the North Kelsey area. The North Kelsey area was looked at potential build-out equals what sort of impact, and a mitigation plan was determined from that. But it seems that I'm hearing the opposite for this out here. Piecemeal. Can you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I think so.
And maybe staff can address that at greater length when you come back to us in 2 weeks. I'm not pushing for an answer.
Right. Right. I don't know if there is a simple answer.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Sounds like there's a lot you still have to put together, and hopefully that will be answered in that report. Commissioners, any other questions at this point? Well, this is a workshop, and we do often open this up to the audience. Is there any opposition to taking comment from the audience? Mm-hmm. Is anyone in the audience wishing to make comments on this particular comprehensive plan amendment? All right, Mr. Terry, go ahead and come on up to the microphone here.
You know the name, Terry.
If you could give us your name and address for the record.
Michael R. Terry. 13829 195th Drive, Southeast, Monroe, 98272. And I'm speaking on my own recognizant behalf. I don't represent any institution or business or even homeowners association for that matter. My only comment was, is there room in the Highway 2 right away for the required size of a roundabout to serve a U.S. highway? Thank you.
Thank you.
I can answer that.
Thank you.
That would be determined by the design of the roundabout, and if there is not sufficient existing right-of-way, the owner or property owner would have to dedicate additional right-of-way to the DOT.
Anyone else wanting to make any comments this evening on this particular item? All right, well, I guess that wraps up the first one. Unless you have anything else on that?
I do not.
All right, then we'll move on to CPA 2012-01 First Airfield Comprehensive Plan Amendment and Rezone. And I'll go ahead and turn that back over to you.
Okay. Just a couple of slides. Here's the property. Tonight what I have is a few tweaks to our past discussions about the definition in the comp plan for limited open space airport and the potential uses. The draft phase environmental impact statement was issued late last month and is out for comment. There will be a public hearing held this Thursday, April 12th, for comments on the draft environmental impact statement for this project. But tonight, just to reiterate what we talked about last time, this same list of criteria that I just talked about for East Monroe, we discussed this at our last meeting in terms of First Air, which is basically a positive application. It is consistent with the plan, and it does meet the other criteria. And of course, like I say, we did go through that. The LOSA definition that we spoke of, I'll call this the final version. We did add a couple of things based on comments from last time to cement this definition. Aviation uses, operations and services, and in response to a suggestion from the commission, to a lesser extent, non-aviation uses. So that gives aviation uses the prime place at the table in terms of these uses. And that the intent of this LOSA is to identify and classify the airport as the principal use in relation to principal versus accessory use, and that the intent is to protect the airport, protect the viability of the airport, and sustain that viability as an operating airport. So it gets pretty specific in reinforcement of the this LOSA as being primarily to identify the principal use airport and protect that principal use and its operations as an airport. So that's where we are with that definition. I think we've improved it pretty well as we've gone along. Mm-hmm. Any comments on this one?
Jeff?
I was looking at the comp plan amendment application and legal description set forth as tax parcels, and it's inconsistent with the tax parcels that are enumerated in the draft EIS. So I think it's important that when this gets to the point where the council has to take action on it, that the area is very clearly defined to which this decision is going to apply. And just want to make sure that that's consistent so we don't run into a problem ex post facto.
Right.
We didn't include this, we included this, and shouldn't have. So it's very clearly laid out what property is in, what property is out. And I can, Paul, another time I can show you what I have to help with that. So,
good, thank you. Take care of that.
Great, thank you. Commissioners, any other comments or questions? Dave?
Thank you, Paul. Paul, I think this has come a long ways as far as the definition goes, and I appreciate the efforts on your part as well as the commission's parts in getting there. I had lunch with a past user of this airport. Some of you will recognize his name, and I'm going to use it, Ben Magnuson. And Ben and I have lunch once in a while. He tries to educate me. He's tried to for many years, and sometimes he makes some progress, and sometimes he doesn't. But he shared with me that, by all means, he was certainly a supporter of this idea and thought that there was good reason behind it. He also told me that at times he thinks I'm a little bit anal, and yet at times understands that given what we get to work on up here, that it's probably appropriate. And I think that another way of putting that might be that sometimes, what is the phrase, devil's advocate? Sometimes when you look at things like this, you need to take on that stance a little bit and play the devil's advocate and pick things apart, because you never know where it's going to end up if you don't really try to look at it from every which way. I don't have a concern with the definition. I think the definition in itself is, like I said, a much further along. I I say I don't have a concern. I may have some concern because I worry about where it leaves staff as far as making some decisions when applications come in once the redesignation is done and the zoning code is amended. And as I look at our list of uses, for the most part, I certainly don't have a problem with those either. The challenge I still see is if someone comes in with an application to build an office building out there of some sort, and let's say they've got the issues of sewer resolved, which I understand is not quite there right now because of the pressure line out there. They want to build an office building. Maybe someone wants to put a hotel up there. How will you as staff, whoever's looking at the application, determine whether the use, which is permitted outright based on our anticipated definitions at this point and allowed uses, is still, for lack of a better word, subservient to the airport, and that it's not taken away from that principal use? I don't want to see us creating code, and I think everyone in the room would agree, that is vague, has lots of room for interpretation, and makes it difficult for staff to answer the questions of folks who come in the front door and want to do something with a piece of property in the city of Monroe. At what point does a hotel become significant enough that it truly is taken away from either the principal use or the potential principal use of this LOSA designated land? Can you expound on that a little bit?
Not really.
Okay. Is that a problem? I mean, if this were to be adopted today, as we are looking at it, does it create a problem for staff 6 months or a year from now?
No, that's kind of a situation that's going to be driven by in a couple of different ways. One is by the airport operator, who would have to be a part of that application process for such a use, unless part of that property was sold off. If that property would still be subject to the intent and the designation of protecting airport operations. A hotel is, in this case, hotel or motel, we're saying would not be an accessory use, since it is such a difficult to call a motel at the airport accessory strictly to the airport, which would be difficult to enforce in any case. But the applicant has come forth proposing things like hotel or restaurant, retail, and so forth to support the airport and, you know, bring some vitality, since it's apparently has not traditionally really functioned as an economic machine on its own, that it needs some supporting facilities to sweeten the operating costs and so forth. But, you know, an application has to be judged in terms of whether it's permitted, and say a hotel, in this case it is, also has to be judged in terms of the context of whether it's the application itself. The use has been judged to meet the intent of this LOSA by being a permitted use. So then it becomes more of a judgment of I don't think staff is in a position to judge the judgment of the applicant or the market that the hotel is something that we're going to build here and what economic impact that might have, plus or minus, on the airport. I think what we have to proceed with here is that these uses are potentially supportive and will contribute to this airport vitality and not penalize it. I'm not sure how a hotel would potentially impact the airport in a negative way, the operations of that airport, since it does have to meet the standards of Chapter 1860, the airport compatibility regulations, in terms of use, size, height, so on and so forth. But bringing more activity to the airport would seem to create the potential for more use, and maybe it's a greater use for the airport itself. So yes, I see it a little bit differently.
And I appreciate that. I just, you use the word judgment a number of times, which...
Well, there's always judgment.
Well...
But it does come down to black and white. Is it permitted use? Yes, and does it meet the bulk standards? And some judgment comes into play sometimes with that. But does it meet the bulk standard? And the answer is yes, then it's entitled and it's approvable.
And that's why I think having the discussion today is better than having it a year from now. Or looking back 5 years from now and saying we should have had that discussion. There's two ways in my mind of, and we heard from Dr. Havoc himself at one point where he said his dental practice enabled the airport to stay open or something to that effect. We're talking about an area of land here to be redesignated as LOSA that could potentially in part be sold off for some sort of other use that's permitted under LOSA to be done by someone else other than the airport owner. That sale could be argued as being supportive of the airport in that it generates dollars for the airport owner. At the same time, it could be argued that sale would be detrimental to the future viability of the airport because it takes away room for airport operations. It takes away room for hangar space. It takes away room for other airport or aviation-related opportunities. And so I think what we're doing here, we're creating a little bit of a double-edged sword. And I think we need to be careful if we're looking at creating opportunities through expansion, longer airfield, flight schools, hangar spaces, if we're creating opportunities for further and greater aviation development, or are we creating opportunities for selling off part of it or redeveloping part of it in other ways that really aren't aviation related, nor are they in the long-term supportive of that aviation goal. So I'm struggling with it. And I'll yield the floor. Thank you.
One response would be that what really should happen here is that if this is approved and entitled, in the interest of the owner, there really should be an airport master plan prepared for this thing, really outline what those facilities are, what the extent of those facilities are, what the operational goals and practices are going to be, which certainly includes the safety aspects of extending and widening the runway. That may also put it in line for some potential grant money for expansion of the airport operations. That would help build a solid base of airport operations. But I think that's the answer to really resolving what may potentially go where in terms of I'll call it a sub-area plan or the official term is an airport master plan for this property. That would, I think, address some of your concerns, because I don't believe there's ever been a master plan done for this airport.
And I think you're absolutely right. It would address the concerns. And my question for you then would be, is that something that gets done as part of this comprehensive plan amendment and rezone?
Something.
Or is it something we just hope gets done at a later date, assuming that the owner of the property at that time is willing to come back and be able to do something like that? And of course, at that point, we have no leverage to require them to do that.
Right. Well, it wouldn't be done as a part of this process. It's beyond our scope. And there was some discussion of that possibility with East Monroe. I think it was in 2006. Council had considered the possibility of a sub-area plan for the East Monroe area, and that was later put off due to lack of funding. Rather than docket it directly, there was an option given to do this sub-area plan to really look at more of the details of it, but that never happened. Same situation here, really, in that sense. That ideally, an airport master plan could address some of those issues, but in a way, is it a cart and horse thing? Which one comes first, and can they come together without changes? As an applicant, without changes that will grant me potential entitlements, I would be hesitant to spend time and money to really develop a master plan for something that may not be able to happen. So there's a little bit of a catch-22 there.
Thank you.
Questions and comments? Bill?
I have a question. I didn't see anything in the what you've given us this week as far as the land trading thing where you have the city land versus airport land so they can extend the runway. Is that down the road yet, or where's that?
That is down the road, but I can tell you what the applicants talked about as a possibility. The runway now ends here. There's 400 or 500 feet of dirt or grass runway, and they're proposing to extend the runway from this point about 600 feet, which brings it to somewhere in this area. That's really the extent of how far they can potentially go. Mm-hmm. But that will require filling of this wetland area to extend that runway. So there's an unavoidable impact if that should happen. But what they're proposing as a part of their mitigation is to, I believe, upgrade some of these wetlands, which have been downgraded somewhat, doing some stream restoration and potentially trading this parcel as open space. This parcel is zoned parks open space, I believe, owned by the city. And this would be the same. That would go a long way toward mitigating the impacts of wetlands here. I mean, it has to be done, I say, a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio for area disturbed. Mm-hmm. But that's a possibility. It has not taken any legs at this point. They also have the possibility of buying off-site wetlands in a wetlands bank to mitigate what they take out here. But a trade of this certainly has some merit.
I would like to jump in kind of back to Dave's concerns. And Dave is always willing to play the devil's advocate, which I appreciate. You always get me thinking about things that I hadn't thought of. But I will say that in this situation, I can appreciate your concerns, and I think they're legitimate, but I think the potential is small, in my opinion, for a conflict like that. I like the definition as it is, probably because I shoved my opinion in there pretty hard on that one. But I haven't been on staff, but I've never been on staff at a city, but when I've dealt with cities, when we're dealing with permits and stuff, I've always gotten the impression that when city staff says this is the way it is, you're kind of, you have to go with it. So I'm comfortable. I feel that the definition gives the city enough position in this to protect the airport. That's my two cents on that.
So, I should make note of a couple things that changes in this table of permitted uses. In trying to work with the single family dwelling issue, we talked about allowing single family homes. I think there were four existing homes, and not allowing any additional, so that single family homes did not become a problem in the future. And the tack that we decided to bring tonight was to eliminate dwelling single family, not allow. That the dwelling caretaker, which could be 1, 2, 3, could be 4 homes, would cover that kind of need in the long run. And I believe of the 4 homes, one is privately owned, and that may be a part of the, the airport is for sale, and may also be a part of that exchange, to where if this amendment and zoning goes through, and especially if a sale is made, that property will also be purchased. But in any case, that house is grandfathered. Should this whole thing fall apart, that one existing privately owned home is grandfathered in and is pretty well protected. If know, if it did burn to the ground, now I'm not going to try and quote the non-conforming regulations, but there's a potential issue there for one dwelling, but in the long range, that house could be redeveloped, maybe even in the short range. So in order to simplify this list, we decided to try the tack of let's address that issue of allowing, having the possibility of, you know, employees or owners, caretakers living on the property, which is taken care of, but there's no maximum here. And we also removed temporary dwelling unit. What that is, come to find out, is a travel trailer, a camping trailer. And those are not allowed anywhere in the city. So they really shouldn't be allowed in most either as a living quarters, other than on a camper on a temporary basis. But that's what that is. That really needs to go.
All right. You know, my memory's going. I thought we had all that figured out, and I hate beating a dead horse. But do you have a definition for caretaker? Like, you know, dwelling caretaker, is that... I don't know what the definition of that is. Maybe there's a definition that covers it and good, but I just...
I don't know if we have a definition in the zoning code for dwelling caretaker at this point, but as part of our cleanup, there are other cases where we have terms or words in the permitted uses that are not defined. So that's another thing that's on the list of things to fix, would be providing some kind of a definition for dwelling caretakers. That could apply to many stories, it could apply to, you know, other potential places where the on-site resident caretaker.
Gotcha. Yeah, my only concern is that, you know, in 20 years from now, when staff is different here, will they know what that intent was?
For the record, in 20 years, I will be nowhere near this.
So that was my only concern. I know you have an idea of what it is, but
I think we'll be able to solve that by maybe a part of this zoning change would be doing it now and creating a dwelling caretaker definition be included as part of the zoning change.
Great. That was my two cents on that. Thank you. Mr. Sachs,
I just wanted to add in that there is, when you remove the single family dwelling from the uses here, you are eliminating an economically viable product for an airport. And typically what we're seeing in the marketplace right now is airport hangars becoming condominiums. And so maybe you build an airport hangar that will support 14 airplanes, and each hangar then would have a loft space with perhaps a kitchenette and a bathroom and a place where a pilot could spend the night, safe, or a businessman flies into Monroe, pulls his airplane into the hangar, does his business, has a little vehicle inside his hangar, goes and does his business in the Puget Sound area, comes back, spends the evening, flies out the next morning. So, and that's a product that airports are increasingly using to create economic viability for the main use, the runway, and it keeps the airport open. So I wanted to just make comment of that and make sure the Planning Commission considers that concept, and we have that in the record.
Thank you. So if I may, for clarification, we're taking out single-family dwellings. This dwelling caretaker, does that allow for that type of scenario? Is that allowed for here in this list of items? Is it something that needs to be added? Is it?
No, I would not interpret dwelling caretaker as including something like a overnight temporary stay for a condo type unit. These what we're calling a workshop facility are these work play areas, but they were not envisioned, at least in this version, as a living unit of any sort. And if it were, that would be something more under the multifamily category.
Mixed use, maybe.
Mixed use. And I'm not sure if the applicant has, I don't recall any discussion of that with the applicant. I may be forgetting. But what's the commission's thoughts about that? We can look into it and consider it.
Dave?
Seems it would make more sense if it were something to the effect of short-term sleeping facility as an accessory use to a hangar space as compared to, say, a single-family dwelling, which I think has a much broader application to address Mr. Sachs's concerns. I think I see a nod back there.
And the intent would not be to live in the space. It would just be a, think of it as a hotel room, you know, personal hotel room, you know, where you could spend the evening there yourself. You would own the place. I suspect that things like this happen anyway in airfields. And I would just, you know, if I don't think we have a term of art right now for whatever this is, but if we could come close to it, I think it would be an enhancement to the business operations of an airfield.
Mr. Sachs, would you anticipate that the same sort of use to be in association, say, with a space that was being used for auto repair or car storage? Or would you limit it to aviation associations?
I think it would be limited to the aviation component. I know they're in talking with some folks that have done this very thing down in Arizona. What they found was is there's a large demand for people who own high-end sports cars to purchase these type of condos. But typically, they use it in conjunction with their private airplane. So maybe they have the Ferrari in Monroe and they have the Lamborghini in Snohomish. Where they land, they drive that car. I'm not being facetious here. There is a marketplace for that type of product. Now, in Monroe, perhaps it's going to be an F-150. There is that combination of uses, and I think there's actually a market for it. So if we could provide that service in Monroe, that brings a businessman into Monroe to spend the evening, or a woman into Monroe, and to spend their business away from business hours in our city instead of Painfield or Arlington.
And I can certainly see some logic behind that. And I appreciate the idea of having it limited to, you know, connected to the aviation use. It just goes further to resolving some of the concerns that I expressed earlier. Speaking of some of those concerns, my comments on the hotel, I was looking at the staff report, which didn't have hotel, motel as accessories, it shows up here, so I apologize for that. I'm not totally clear on how staff would evaluate an application, an accessory application, and I think that that's something that needs to be developed, because I don't believe we have it, at least not as it relates to these uses. And along with that, I'm wondering when the bulk standards that we have will be visited in this process, or are we just looking at incorporating the ones that we currently have for LOSA, which includes 100% lot coverage, for instance? We're looking at and no minimum lot size. Are we looking at just incorporating that, or will we be revisiting that as well in this process?
No, actually, I had not envisioned that in this process. But there, we may need to at least cover some of the very basics in the matrix, in the zoning code, in terms of some very basic lot standards.
And as an example, the commercial use has no minimum lot size in the LOSA. So I think that there are some issues there that need to be addressed during this process, rather than trying to go back and patch the code 6 or 8 or 12 months down the road. Mm-hmm. You know how we all like doing that. Thank you.
And I don't want to be a troublemaker, but I think an accessory is actually being deleted.
Yeah, it is.
On hotel?
The red.
And retail, and parking, and restaurant.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So
just for clarification.
Our concerns with that.
Bill, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I just have a concern. I think it goes a little bit with what Commissioner Demarest was talking about earlier, is that as these things being added to the airport property, they're not going to be added all at once, I'm sure, but as they are being added, how do we stop when it reaches that critical tipping point where now it's not so much for the airport anymore, it's more a commercial area? How do we make sure that that doesn't happen?
Wait.
I don't know how that happens. You're out of the room.
Well, I can see it becoming a problem before you run out of room, where you now become, it becomes more a commercial area than it does an airport.
I think Wayne has the right idea that there is a pretty limited amount of area that could potentially be developed, especially adjacent to the heart of the airport, the runway. That's the obvious place for more of the aviation uses or the closely related non-aviation uses. But as in regards to other things like retail or offices or hotel, there's a very limited amount of area, and I don't know if that would ever be able to reach any kind of critical mass that would threaten the viability of the airport, unless the airport became defunct, unless you simply abandoned and redeveloped it as a non-airport. And that, under private ownership, the comp plan certainly supports this as a essential public facility, but that's not to say that the owner could not decide to shut down that airport and redevelop it as a take a choice, different kind of use.
Would such redevelopment require an amendment to the comp plan?
It would, to do anything that's not allowed within LOSA.
But what if the airport went away, the operating airport?
But the intent, if you go back to the intent of the LOSA, that would certainly restrict how much could be done. I mean, the intent is to protect the viability of the airport. If that's not going to happen, then the comp plan would have to be amended. LOSA is no longer a valid use, a valid category.
Yeah, I would agree. I almost think, having it say, with the definition saying it's long-term viability as an operating airport, I would think it would be, I think that protects it, in my opinion.
That's all subject to future amendments, but
correct.
Could happen.
To comprehensive plan amendments, yes. If I may, I'd like to borrow one of Commissioner Sherwood's comments, I think, regarding this turning into more of a commercial zone. I think the market will probably take care of the demand for aviation uses. I think we'll probably take care of that if I remember a comment like that. The one question I also have, Mr. Sachs, you had mentioned something about these dwelling units, if you will, above these hangars, that they wouldn't own them. If they're like boat slips, sometimes you rent them, sometimes you own them, almost like a condo. And I could see, is that the same way it is with hangars? Could somebody own the hangar and above? And I'm not saying it's bad. Or they could possibly rent both. I'm not saying one's preferable.
They could definitely condominiumize the entire hangar space, sell each hangar to an individual owner. Or the airport could own the hangars and lease them out,
sure,
like boat slip, that sort of thing.
Great. Now, did we fully address that issue, or is that a definition that you're going to come up with for us for our next meeting then?
Yeah, I was going to say there is an official zoning term definition as sleeping quarters, which is not a living unit. If you think of it, I've dealt with this in terms of assisted living, where the unit is shy of a full dwelling unit. There is no kitchen to speak of, minimal kitchen. It's basically sleeping quarters. And in this case, it could be a very minor sort of living area, sleeping area, Maybe there's a microwave. Used to be a hot plate, now it's a microwave. But it's not a dwelling unit. It's distinct. Sleeping quarters is distinct from a dwelling unit. And that, and I think it should be qualified that way. We're not trying to promote dwelling units out here for full-time residency.
Would it allow for a like a full bath with a shower and a
right.
refrigerator, microwave, that kind of a thing?
Maybe, it's, I mean, you can restrict it down to even the requirements for the so-called kitchen. You'll have a small refrigerator, no stove, very basic plumbing.
But you say we have a current definition?
We do not here, but but there is a commonly used definition for that, called the sleeping quarters, that distinguishes it from a dwelling unit, which might be something appropriate here.
Great. And I would like to hear what the other commissioners have to say about this, but I also, we are going to get to the audience at some point here. Commissioners, any comments on this sleeping quarters and preference?
I think it's a fine idea. Right.
Okay. I think it's okay.
I already said I would support that. Would we be doing the development of those aspects during this process, or is that something we'll talk to later? Those standards?
No.
No? Okay.
Soon.
That's good.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I agree. So I think we probably can handle it and bring it up just at the next meeting. Is there anything else, commissioners? Staff, I think you're down to your... the end of your presentation there, is that right? Did I say?
I think so.
Might as well open it up to the audience. Oh, sorry, Jeff.
I think when we, you know, the environment there has been pretty stable for a while. You've had the fairgrounds, you've had the airport. You have a reasonably busy road, 179. When the service commercial zone, I believe, was applicable to those two properties, the southeast corner of the airport, the market put a tent-making facility on there. And when Dave sold his piece to the gentleman who makes the tents, he expanded the tent-making facility. He didn't put in a Ivers restaurant or a hotel. He put in a manufacturing facility, which was permitted in that zone. When we look over the Frylands on the retail development that's done there, you have several hundred homes there that are backing that up, and they still haven't been able to fill it. So I don't see runaway commercial development taking place on this property. And I think the market is going to protect us in that respect that you just mentioned. So I think that, you know, the way we have it now, without being overly burdensome on someone who's trying to come in there and actually do something, that we have tweaked so fine that we make it impossible for someone to succeed in trying to, you know, make this airport viable. That's the only caution I would throw into this, is that we do not treat it that way and try to protect ourselves from everything that someone might possibly do in the future. I think that's ridiculous. We have to grant some leeway. In the 1860, you know, the airport compatibility thing, the spirit of that, which already exists, is to make sure that the airport is supported in all the decisions that are made. And we recommend a pre-application. What are you going to do? Well, we're going to turn this into a three-ring circus. Well, you can't do that here. And this is why. So we're protected. And to tweak it to this level, I think, is just a bit much. And I'm done.
Commissioners, any other comments?
I agree with Jeff. Things change, as we have seen. There's no sense having a place to tie your horse up anymore in Monroe. And later on, maybe there'll be a place to put other things. And I agree with what you said, Jeff. Leave it open for change.
Excellent. Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to make any comments this evening? Dr. Hammond? And as usual, if you could just give us your name and address for the record, sir.
Kim? Daryl Pettit, 13812 179th Avenue Southeast, Monroe.
Thank you, sir.
Well, it's heartening to hear that there seems to be a fair amount of support for the project. I think a lot of the fears that any of us that sat on the commission would have are centered around the possibility that somebody could do something. And we are creating LOSA, Airport Limited Open Space. And with that, that's your hammer. If it's something that doesn't fit in that, it's not going to work. And it was very aptly pointed out that the dimensions of the property and the availability of property that you could actually develop, there's a 125-foot setback from the center of the runway. And so you've got 125 feet either side of the runway, you can't put anything. And then there's a 7-to-1 ratio from there out. So it does limit what you can do. And I think between the federal air rigs and really good planning, which I think you guys have done very well, and I really think that a lot of the fears about what might happen, no matter who owns it, and it may still be me 40 years from now. No. But that's all I have to say. I really appreciate Paul. You worked really hard on definitions, and we just can't answer everything. And Commissioner Tuttle brought that up last meeting. She said, you know, we might have a totally different city council, a totally different planning commission, a totally different vision for this city. And I think right now our mayor is very progressive. He wants to see Monroe really become something. And this is one of the gateways, is having a really viable airport. So I wish you all well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jeff?
Yeah, I just want to make something for the record. Today, I asked permission to go with Daryl to look at the property, just like envisioned. I just want to mention that we met on the property and looked around the property, in case I need to say that.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to make any comments this evening? Mr. Terry? And again, if you could give us your name and address for the record.
I'm the same, Mr. Terry.
Thank you.
I'm not an aircraft owner. I'm not a pilot. I'm speaking just for myself. I have no business interest in the topic we're addressing. I'm a resident in the Monroe Municipal Code 1860 Zone 6B. I am very comfortable with the care and understanding that aircraft airfield operations have provided for, as I understand it, something like 43 years in the city of Monroe, thanks to Dr. Haggard's command of the situation. I'm very comfortable. There's only one airplane that flies over my house that I like, but anyway, I'm very comfortable with it. I am not here to impede in any way the airport. My concern is that if we're not careful, we'll do something to the airport that opens up a box, that stirs up a hornet's nest. What could that possibly be? Well, I'd like to quickly, because I know we don't have a lot of time here. It, in my mind, is an issue of airport airspace. The FAA, I'm sure, has a different term for that and so on. But it's that three-dimensional, I think you can view it as an oval, but it's an oval that has slopes. It's like a football stadium kind of restricted zone, affected zone, where the people and the operations and the uses, land uses, are controlled to make sure that the airport, which is a little part of that, whole thing remains viable. The current airfield, for the record, is described in Washington DOT W16 Airport Facilities and Services. And that was established, that listing, which is available online, was established in 2012. It describes W16, the current airport. There was also a Washington Department of Transportation airfield W16 economic analysis conducted. I couldn't really tell, but it refers to situations in 1998. If you go to airnav.com, you can find for W16, for aviators primarily, the FAA information for this airport. And I've looked at that currently for 5 April 2012. The Municipal Code 1860, for the record, is an airport overlay zoning code. There might be some details to that I'm missing. But that was established some time ago. I think it was 2007. That current situation with First Air is described as small aircraft in FAA-FAR parlance, that's less than 12,500-pound gross weight. Please correct me, but not right now, if I got that all screwed up. I've only had a couple of days to look at this. It also says that it's a less than 91 knot approach speed kind of airport. It's a day use airport. It has just visual support of operations. My concern is the viability of an airport in Monroe. If there is going to be economic expansion of the airport, I'll leave that undefined at the moment, but a number of people throughout the workup of workshops and so on have talked about expansion, increased volume, increased aviation capabilities. That runs across the expansion of the airport overlay zoning volume. In other words, if you extend a runway with all of the zoning tied to the ends of the runway and the sides of the runway, and they're larger, then the affected zone, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 of the municipal code, will have to change. In some regards, very little. Very little. However, going from a 2,000-foot official runway length to 3,200-foot official runway length is over 50% increase. And so you can imagine what the increase is just in accordance with offsets from the FAR based on accident data and all that sort of thing, what that volume, three-dimensional volume, is going to grow to. The postcard that I received is the only reason I'm here. And I want to thank the city for giving me a postcard. I had no idea from my real estate description, from my deeds, from my homeowners association, CCNRs, on and on and on, that there was any restriction of my residence and that it was in 6B. That postcard refers to the California Airport Land Use Planning Handbook. It was dated in 02. As far as I can see, but I could be wrong, the municipal code that we have, 1860, is based on that. Why do I think that? Because the postcard is the exact overlay from the municipal code, and it refers to the California handbook. Well, that's good. But subsequent to that, Washington State Department of Transportation has looked at airport features and the aircraft overlay safety regions and so forth. And that is Washington State Department of Transportation Airport and Compatibility Land Use Guidebook, dated January 2011. Why do I bring this up? If the expansion that we are talking about in this action that you're addressing extends and changes the category of airport in the Washington State Department of Transportation guides, there's a chance that not only would the Washington State Department of Transportation or the Snohomish County land use people, but many people in the people space of this airspace causing turmoil. I mean hornet's nests. I mean, do you really want that? Is there any way to avoid that and keep this airport viable? Well, my concern is that the Washington State categories of airports for safety, features, and so forth, operations of aircraft, are classed as 3,000-foot runways or less, 3,000 to 5,000-foot runways, and 5,000 and on up. To give you an idea of what that means, in the Washington State Department of Transportation guide, if you have a less than 3,000 foot runway, this is in page F9 of the guides, the zone 4 is 2,500 feet long and 500 foot wide. The zone 6 is 5,000 foot long, 5,000 foot wide. If you go...
I'm sorry, we're approaching 10 minutes. I don't know how much longer you have to go.
Just a short.
Great, thank you.
To put it in perspective, if it is greater than 3,000 foot runway, zone 4 is 6,000 foot long, I mean wide, and 7,000 foot long. So we see an increase of almost 50% of all these volumes. Zone 4 becomes very close to Rainier View Road. Why? Because Rainier View Road in that area is almost on the axis of the airport. To avoid this kind of stirring up and so on, my recommendation is that we take a very close look at whether this airport, for viability purposes and the future and economic growth and so on, really wants to be more than 3,000 feet. Really wants to be night operations. Really wants lighting, beacons, and airport landing equipment and so on for night operations. And do we really want to have all these people spaces and air spaces brought into a consultation, steps 1 through 6, of the Washington Department of Transportation land use guide?
Thank you, sir.
If I may.
Mr. Happ, Dr. Happ, go ahead.
Thank you. Good research. I would not pretend to have memorized all the books. The 07 California was the standard in the state of Washington. In 2011, I wasn't even aware they had it. But I'll tell you, we're talking about a 3,200 foot runway. A 3,000 foot was category one, which wouldn't change from where we are. Our runway right now is 2,600 counting the grass. Well, I land on the grass. A lot of people land and take off on the grass. So we're going to extend it 600 feet. Okay, that's not a 50% increase. Number two, very simply, we, all the planning commission and the city council, we've talked about, well, we want to limit this. How you do it? You put a display threshold on that runway. The only reason, the only critical reason that we are extending the runway is for safety. It's not going to bring any bigger airplanes, any faster airplanes. You cannot land on 3,200 feet with a jet. I mean, unless you're, you know, really good. But it's whether you can land. We already have a display threshold over the proposed off-ramp, the Flight 22, which was, has never been built. Had that all along. We have wires. PUD has wires on the other end. We have to get over those. You're limited. But when you do touch down, you need a place so that you can put on the brakes and stop. If for accelerate stop purposes, and that's safety, okay, you pour the coal to it, you get her to lift off speed, chop the power, put on the brakes, can you stop? 3,200 feet is what it takes for my airplane that I've been operating in and out of there for 15 years, if I want to carry a passenger for hire. So it's a safety issue. And I know once you say, oh, we're going to extend the runway, gosh, Southwest Airlines is going to show up. No, they're not. No different airplanes, no more noise. In fact, it'd be probably less noise. The more modern airplanes are quieter. But you're going to have the exact same activity at the airport, just with more safety, which you probably will have some more airplanes. Hopefully, we do. And all these accessory uses are going to support that runway. That's a $1 million runway. Somebody's got to pay for it. And I've been doing pretty good so far, but, you know, kind of running out of the dough. So I just like to alleviate any kind of public outcry about, oh my gosh, we're going to extend this runway. It has to do with safety? Absolutely not. We're not putting any bigger, faster airplanes in here. We will get more, hopefully. But that's it. So I appreciate your research, and it really was quite complete. And the California model, I'm glad Washington State finally did their own, because that's what our whole overlay is based on. But if you don't want any airplane to come in there, you just displace the runway. You displace the threshold. Simple as that. Okay?
Okay. Thank you, Doc.
Mr. Paul?
Yes.
Dr. Head?
Yeah.
That's a simple question. The end of the paved runway is here.
Yes.
And you have...
We go all the way to the
feet of dirt.
Yeah, well, there's a...
When you're talking about extending the runway 600 feet...
Right.
Is that from
it's
here?
It's about the amount. It's or about the here? Amount. Yeah. No, you're going to extend it to... It's going to extend...
Does it extend... Oh, yeah, right. Okay. There. Out here. That's what I thought. Thank you.
What is that paved? You're extending it to that point paved?
Yes, and we talked about that too, where we probably use pervious concrete so we would mitigate the effects to the wetlands.
Sorry, thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry, thanks. Sorry. As you can see, we're pretty casual.
I know you are. That's a good idea. I apologize.
Yeah, so we try to have everybody address the commission, and if you can always discuss after the meeting with each other too. And thank you, sir, for your comments, Mr. Terry. Is there anyone else wanting to address the Planning Commission tonight on this topic? To give us some more information, there will be a public hearing in 2 weeks on this also. So, seeing no hands, I think we are ready to move on. And the next item is CPA 2012B, North Kelsey and Downtown Plan Update. Planning Manager Pavelka, I think you're doing this also.
Yes, to recap, we've talked about this a couple of times, taking the North Kelsey and Downtown plans out of the comp plan and replacing with goals and policies for both of those. North Kelsey image, I've seen that before. Now, going back to revisit the North Kelsey material, let me talk about downtown. We put together a very rough set of goals and potential goals and policies for downtown that were pulled out of the downtown master plan. Because right now, the comp plan, it has some narrative about North Kelsey and about downtown, and I think you had attachment that was the land use element. So there are some revisions to be done in those, what, three or four pages that just talk about those areas, the existing conditions and the future vision. But besides that, in relation to downtown, downtown does not have any specific goal or policies in the comp plan right now. North Kelsey has one of each. But we put together a very rough set of draft goals and policies and shared that with the Dream Board of Directors, and they have not, the only feedback I've gotten back so far is that their main concerns have to do with, other than the obvious things like long-term viability, of supporting ongoing events and making downtown, ensuring that it is a attractive, safe, visible place that people will come to for events and have a memorable experience and come back. That's where those folks are really coming from. And I think that in terms of attracting both residents and visitors, but certainly an ongoing program of events that gives people a reason to come downtown. But I'm going to try and get that worked out here this week as well, and turn that into a set of goals and policies that I can send you well ahead of our next meeting as well for downtown. Now, this has not changed since we met last. A couple of simple revisions to the North Kelsey goal, and then converting what were North Kelsey plan goals into policies for the comprehensive plan. We talked about these. North Kelsey plan had a goal to increase the city's economic vitality, and we've changed it into a policy, which is a subset to this overall goal of the North Kelsey area. Same, we took out the focal point, the Village Green. That's going to be transferred or translated into the policies for downtown. We kept the North Kelsey language about serving the, you know, this diverse population with diverse commercial uses as a policy, and then a couple of changes. Now policy that talked about architectural design and how that's treated, and I had a phrase here about public art, and we had some discussion about that, and what I pulled directly from the North Kelsey plan was, the way they put it was, it involves local artists where possible. It's not a direct referral to public art per se, although this does, you know, give some direction in that direction. And this last one has not changed from our last discussion, but which deals with the pedestrian environment and separation of pets, vehicles, bikes, and so forth. But we did delete the last goal from the North Kelsey Development Plan, the one that talked about complementing but not contrasting downtown, and you know, we kind of severed that link. In reality, they are two different places that exist not because of each other, but almost in spite of each other. And they can coexist quite well. But we eliminated the language that I think in that case was almost trying to replicate downtown and North Kelsey, which is not the case. So that's where we're at with that. Any questions about these at this point?
Yeah, convert NK Goal 5 to the OU Policy 2.5. The only concern with that, Paul, is that this being a bit passé now does not end up being something that is economically burdensome to someone who wants to come in and develop there. Mm-hmm. That we emphasize something that's pretty much gone by the wayside, to the point where someone's going to have to come up with six figures to do enhancements that, you know, you may get one or two people a day using it. That's my major concern with that. And I assume that on a case-by-case basis that can be addressed. But this sounds kind of open-ended cost-wise. That's the only concern I have. So, just wanted to...
I think this has worked okay in the past. I do favor keeping some language about not ignoring pedestrians and accommodating pedestrians. And there is some of that in place now, safe bicycle access. Really what it comes down to is what's in the design guidelines or AKA design standards. And Walmart, for example, didn't have any problem meeting the intent of this or the guidelines, design guidelines in relation to that site development. So I don't think this creates any additional burden in terms of what I would call a normal desirable practice.
Thank you.
And I would say I agree with Jeff too. I actually, with the Walmart thing, took issue with pedestrian friendly, and it became pedestrian accessible. And I know the idea is to not have it be like the Albertsons parking lot where you can't really walk from one area to the other without worrying about getting hit by a car. But I agree, because I don't want it to be interpreted as overly cumbersome either. But I do want to see, I think it's kind of a more modern thing now anyway, like at Target where there's a walkway between the parking just so people can get around. So as long as that's the intent of this wording, I'm fine with that. But if we're asking businesses to do, like create, I don't know, something specifically for pedestrians, then I wouldn't really be... I just want to make sure the intent is the way I understand it. Just to make it easier for pedestrians to get around or someone to ride a bike. I remember going through the discussion over Walmart, so.
Dave?
I think we've been told this isn't regulatory anyway, right?
That's right, it's not regulatory.
Okay.
And in that regard, it could have, if someone made a valid argument for it, could be totally disregarded.
Well, I think it has some value in that it addresses, in my opinion. Have you watched The Good Wife?
Yeah.
In my opinion. gives the pedestrian a means of getting from that automobile, and these places are very dependent on arriving by automobile, from the car to the store, or perhaps in some cases to maybe the pad within that big box development or to the front door of that without having to traverse through a just solid parking lot. I've seen cases where there's like maybe one kind of spine walkway, but you know, people are going to walk. And when you walk from your car to the front door, you don't walk in a straight line. You tend, at least I tend to zigzag between cars and I make my way that way. But if we can improve the pedestrian environment, at least even in a minimal way, to just relieve some of that asphalt heat and a little bit of shade, and make it a little more, you know, just give the pedestrian a little bit of thought as how I can best get from my car to that front door, knowing that I'm going to come back out from my car and get in to go to the next place. But I don't think this requires anything extraordinary at all. And I think it's a good policy as a general direction. Don't forget the bottom of this.
Dave?
Well, I concur. I think that, you know, I drive that road every day at least once, actually at least twice. And I marvel at the number of people that walk down our trail along Chain Lake Road and back up it. And I take note too of the people that walk from the south side of Highway 2 up to that area. There are really quite a few. And I don't think we want to do anything to discourage that. I hope that we can continue to encourage it throughout this area for those that choose to be mobile that way.
and I think John Mendels would cringe if you heard me say this, but safe bicycle access throughout the development. I don't know what that. What does that look like? I
want to say something about
it. Maybe it's fine, but I just.
I think that is bike lanes in the streets.
But through the parking lots?
Yeah, it says throughout the development. I don't know. I mean, because I think we do have some on Turning, don't we? We have some bike lanes in there. They're small.
I think so.
Yeah. That's what it means. It's good. We don't need to change it. I've
wondered about that. If you're going to go shopping on a bicycle, what are you going to buy?
Something you can put in a bag and you can hang over your handlebars, I guess.
Yeah.
I would like to point out, though, since while this is not regulatory language, it informs the regulations within the city. So you can't change the zoning regulations, can't be any more lenient than what's written here. The comprehensive plan informs the zoning code. So I understand what Bridget said when it says pedestrian friendly, pedestrian accessible, or perhaps those are better words, what is safe bicycle access throughout? Does that include the parking lots, or does that just include the public right-of-ways? I think it deserves maybe some tweaking and then reinforce what the policy language is saying once we get out to the zoning code.
Mr. Saxon, your interpretation, by it saying encouraging, it then mandates that it be incorporated into the zoning code?
In essence, the zoning code and the comprehensive plan need to be consistent.
And I understand that. So the zoning code, in turn, needs to encourage these things, but not require.
What does encourage mean?
Well, it's the difference between shall and may, isn't it?
Well, encourage can mean one of two things when you get to the zoning code. It could be shall or it could be should. And that's going to be determinant on the policymakers at that time. So these words, while it is policy language, it doesn't form the code.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Jeff is right that this does inform the zoning code, but this says encourage or should or consider. Zoning code should say you will or you shall. And the zoning code is where the rubber meets the road, and that you take the intent of this and really in my mind where this comes into play is that if you have a site plan that's submitted, is there reasonable pedestrian access within this development? And are there areas for pedestrians? Are there sidewalks, just basic sidewalks? Or is there maybe an entry plaza that needs to be a part of this, which you could encourage the applicant to include in the site plan? I don't think it mandates a pedestrian-dominated environment, because it is indeed an automobile-dominated environment. It may be something as simple as encourage pedestrian-accessible development. Maybe that's the one word that tends to throw people off instead of pedestrian friendly. It's a matter of semantics, I think.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think some of this almost sounds regulatory at parts, like where I was asking about the safe bicycle access throughout the development. I mean, I like, and minimize blank walls. To me, that's general enough that it's not regulatory, and vehicles along arterials where possible, to me seems more general. So I don't know if it needs a whole lot of tweaking, but maybe a little bit. Just some of it has a feel as regulatory to me, is all. And maybe changing pedestrian friendly to pedestrian accessible will get us there.
And what are streetscape amenities? We're talking flower pots.
Oh, we could be talking street trees, sidewalks that aren't 4 feet wide, but maybe 5 or 6 feet wide. You could ratchet all the way up from simply street trees to street trees and street furniture, benches, trash receptacles, pedestrian lights. But, you know, in this case, the primary part of that is street trees, which gives some separation between heads and the traffic, and also gives some design image to the street. You know, envision a street with street trees, especially as they grow, and one without. It's just a blank slate. Mm-hmm. World of difference there. Where would you rather walk if you were walking from one place to another?
Rob?
Yeah. Trees. Trees. I have a little problem with trees. Bushes, yeah, I like bushes. Trees, I have leaves, and it's a mess. I have them all over my yard, and I noticed Fryland Boulevard is a mess in the fall. And then also the trees, the roots like to push the sidewalks up and ruin them. So the bushes and the flowers, I go along with. But the trees, no.
I tend to want to make all these definitions, and I don't know if I should, but, you know, what comes to my mind is the development should provide pedestrian accessibility, safe pedestrian accessibility for, between uses and, I don't know.
Because then the zoning will be more specific, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Then in the zoning you get more specific about, streetscape amenities for pedestrians, separation of pedestrian and vehicles. It seems to me like the comprehensive plan is always very, this is our goal and not regulatory. To me, it feels regulatory. Maybe it isn't. Maybe there's just so many words that it just comes across as regulatory. Dave?
I thought we were immersed in this discussion because we were told it was too regulatory, it wasn't supposed to be that way, and it needed to be undone from a regulatory perspective. So what are we doing here, folks?
Well, I threw out an idea as far as a definition. If we're going to go there, does anybody else have an idea of what how we can streamline this?
My only caution would be don't cut it down to where we have no idea what the intent of this is.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
I like the word reasonable because it just allows for negotiation. Where I come from is I look at cost estimates to build projects, and there may be $5 or $10 per square foot of amenities, and that's going to come out of somebody's hide down the road somewhere. And to me, it does not encourage development when it costs so much to develop that it doesn't encourage development. That was the spirit of why you brought this up. Is not so much what you do and don't do. What's it going to cost someone who comes into this town and wants to place a use here? Do we look at everybody that comes in like a big turkey, to coyote? Right? Another meal on which we can make ourselves, full. So that we look at these people coming in and developing as a means of getting these little things we want. That's unreasonable in my estimation. So that's why I brought it up in the first place.
Yeah. We could have philosophical debate about that. I've done an awful lot of development cost estimating and construction and so forth. But the value of this, the intent of this, is to get something better than bare bones minimum function, forming function. We don't want vanilla, and we can have vanilla with a dollop of chocolate. Poor analogy, but you know, to set the standard just a little bit higher, and don't accept just what is minimally required. I spent a lot of time trying to push developers to do just a little more than what was absolutely required, because there is a return there. You know, when you build a development that has only minimal attraction and draw for the consumer, whatever that consumer might be, that sets that apart as different from one that does include amenities and draws the customer. It's going to cost more in the beginning, but the long-term return is usually better, all things being equal.
I think in the modern development environment, everybody expects that some of this is going to have to be part of the package. But they don't want it to be overwhelming. That's all.
Thank you. I guess my question is there more detailed regulation within the code that addresses some of these things more specifically? And if so, I don't think we're at a major risk of losing the intent if we're willing to take another look at this, I guess is where I'm trying to go with this. Here, I just threw something together real fast. My thought is, taking Commissioner Sherwood's recommendation, provide reasonable pedestrian access within the development and between developments. This may include sidewalks and other means of separating vehicles and pedestrians. I mean, to me, that seems like a direction. You know, it's not completely empty, but yet is not so specific that we're regulating within the comprehensive plan. And I'm willing to hear any other comments.
Well, I would even say that that's getting almost regulatory. It's calling for sidewalks to separate, however you put that, but.
Yeah, I said may include sidewalks or other means of separating vehicles from pedestrians.
I think just a simple statement of separation of pedestrians and vehicles, you know, where possible. That doesn't mandate anything, but you know, I think we're chasing our tails here.
Right. Dave?
I'm gonna agree with Paul. I think for where the city wants to go, where staff wants to go, this seems to be it. And I think we spend days debating it, having philosophical discussions about it, and we'll probably end up right back here. So yeah. Perhaps we should move on.
Yeah, think a little.
Everybody's okay with that?
Think a little.
To me, it just felt regulatory, but
no. And I think there's value in having the discussion so that when it comes down to the zoning, the intent is understood. And so we've done that.
Well, we are. Continuing, I mean, the North Kelsey design guidelines and the downtown design guidelines are both in the zoning code now and are enforced through the code. And there may be some tweaking that we may want to do with those at some point, but they are there now. And they were developed based on, at least theoretically, based on these policy guidelines. And I don't know that anyone's had any heartache in applying those design standards in the developments we've had downtown, or not so much downtown, but in North Kelsey. That's a problem with signage, but you know, that's a couple cases of unintended consequences.
Yeah. All right.
That's all I have. I will get you the downtown materials as quickly as possible while we control analysis as quickly as possible, not the Friday before the meeting.
Commissioners, any other questions or comments? Well, we may actually end up out of here before we have to extend our meeting.
Maybe.
If we heard. I guess comments from commissioners and staff, is there Paul, anything?
Think so. You know, First Airport public hearing Thursday night. then all this coming back together 2 weeks from tonight, the final phased environmental impact statement should be out this week for East Monroe, and you should all get a copy of that when it becomes available, and that's sent out.
Thank you.
That's about it.
Thank you. Bill, anything?
Excuse me, did you say the public hearing Thursday?
Yes, Thursday this week. It's not a commission run or commission public hearing, just a public hearing.
Okay.
You know, city sponsored.
Only question I had, public hearing Thursday.
In fact, I should say if more than three of you may show up at that public hearing, we would have to notice that as a public meeting. So if anybody is going to attend, you know, please make sure that there aren't more than three of you.
Jeff?
I'm good.
Dave?
Nothing.
Wayne?
The last meeting we had, we were about the garden in Monroe, and the next day I went down to our coffee break we have. I tried to explain to our coffee break buddies about the garden, and they did not believe me.
Are you talking about the cooperative garden?
Yes. Yes.
They would not believe me. They don't believe me to this day.
Yeah. Okay. Bridget, anything?
No, thank you.
Any word on the applicant? Sort of get that?
For the planning commission?
Yeah.
Now, we have a blurb on the website.
Okay.
But we have not received any applications.
All right.
We'll switch them.
Okay. Well, if that is it, I want to entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Motion made by Commissioner Sherwood, seconded by Commissioner Demarest. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
I know, because when he handed it to you, you took it out and held it with a pen. He's just talking, he doesn't realize what he's doing.
I went and bought this myself.
I was going to,
800 feet.
Take your eye out.
Or maybe it's...